Sexual Purity, Biblical or Victorian? The fifth talk in a series titled Sodom and Sexual Purity was presented by Nancy Scott on February 4, 2003, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Tonight's topic is something that I didn't know much about until I started preparing for this, so I've been doing some reading, and it's been pretty interesting reading. And what I'm going to try to do is just share with you guys some of what I've discovered about the context of sort of the Victorian notions about sexuality and how they might influence the pendulum swing that we're in now, that has rejected any kind of decorum or restraint about our sexuality. And then I will go from there to try to outline what I think a biblical perspective is, and then talk about some of the issues that raises. So, and then we'll leave plenty of room for Jack and I to have a little bit of a conversation and then to have a wider discussion. Okay. So, one of the things I discovered in my reading was that in the 19th century, which is typically thought of as the Victorian era, Queen Victoria, I guess, was queen like from 1836 to 1900 or 1896 or somewhere in there. Anyway, she was the queen for the longest period of any of the English monarchy. And so her name is on the period, even though I don't think that she herself and her policies necessarily had very much to do with defining what we think of as Victorian views on sexuality. It was more just the period of the 19th century that we think of that way. So, and coming up to that time, there were certain theological ideas that were held in this country, Protestant more so than Catholic, but there are some threads there. Turns out that there's kind of these two threads that happen in the 19th century, and one of them is this theological thread, and then the other one is this sort of medical progress sort of thread, and that they kind of converge into this understanding that says sex is really bad, and so you need to avoid it at all costs, of course, except if you want to have kids, and then you might, you know, do it once per child. So there were two competing views, theologically speaking. One was that sex shared the universal corruption caused by sin. The other was that sex actually transmitted sin. And so there was this shift in thinking about, and it kind of started apparently with Finney and the perfectionist movement, that sin was starting to be seen as something that was about obedience or disobedience, not something that was inherent in who we are as humans. So the biblical view, I would argue, sees our sin nature as something that is inherent in our humanness. That is, there's something deeply broken about us that we can't fix by doing things differently. The school that followed Finney and the perfectionists claimed that if we just figure out how to obey God, then we can actually improve. There's no reason we actually have to sin for the rest of our lives. We can do stuff. Of course, that takes redefining what sin is. Well, so this kind of combined with this understanding of sexuality that they had a lot of debate about original sin and where it comes from and how we transmit it from generation to generation. And in the end, what they came up with was that sex was, if sex was lustful, then you transmitted original sin to your offspring. If sex was pure and under subjection to Christ and his authority and not lustful, then you could actually give birth to a child who isn't defiled by a sin nature, in a way. So this was kind of an odd thing, I think, to come up with, but in the context of the time and place, it actually made some sense. And there were two guys in particular. This was the part that was particularly intriguing to me. Mr. Kellogg, who started us all off on cornflakes, as well as Mr. Graham, who invented the graham cracker, came up with ideas about controlling our passions by eating certain ways. And this was motivated by this desire to control our sexuality in a way that would purify it. So they recommended diet, and because appetite was another, appetite was another place where passion could come and derail us. So our sexuality needed to be devoid of passion, basically, because passion was the problem. So that was the theological thread, kind of seeing original sin as passed down through a certain kind of sexual act. Then another thing that was happening in the 19th century was the development of medical science that was coming out of the Enlightenment thinking and kind of rational school of thought that was starting to see things reduced down to its component parts and seeing our bodies and starting to understand things about how our bodies work. Well, apparently the American Gynecologist Society started in this country in like the 1880s. They were actually leading in the world as far as looking at diseases of the female reproductive system and actually finding help for problem pregnancies, for things that happen to women's bodies during childbearing, ways to repair damage that was caused during childbirth, things like that. They made big strides in the medical realm. But along with that came this kind of shifting of authority that the doctors now were the ones who should be telling you what you should or shouldn't be doing physically with your sexuality, because they have information that is actually more accurate and more needed. And so along the same lines, this theological thread comes in, and this medical thread, well, it converged into sort of the physicians, as I understand it, then started to equate, kind of have these theories about what an orgasm was physiologically, and that it maybe was a precursor to epilepsy, or that it was something that was not healthy at all for your body. Combined with sort of a biological view, looking at us as animals in the continuum, as Darwin's ideas were getting more credence and seeing evolution as a continuum. In biology, if you study a lot of species, reproduction happens shortly before death in many kinds of animals, particularly insects. A lot of different critters reproduce and then die pretty quickly thereafter. So these guys also decided on a medical level that our sexuality gave out a really significant part of our life force. And so to have sex a lot meant you were going to die sooner, basically, because this was part of what sex was seen as part of our life force. And so to conserve your strength, it was thought that you would want to have sex as little as possible. And then with the medical stuff that happened, women ended up being sort of the gatekeepers of sex, in the sense that the doctors were the ones telling them they really should help their husbands control their life force from going out of them, and yours too. And the women are actually who had the most to lose in their sexuality, because they were the ones that had to have the children and go through a lot of things physically. And so that's how the doctors kind of framed it for them, that they should be the ones in charge of restraining their husbands' appetites and therefore helping to have a healthier life. And that so it was medically important for that to happen. So this idea that original sin is going to be transmitted through a lustful kind of sexual activity, along with this medical view that sexuality was really not good for you, that combined into this cultural and social climate that we think of now as the Victorian era, where sex is thought of as dirty and bad and you shouldn't do it. It makes sense in the context of how people were thinking about what our sexuality was. So these two threads came together to support the repression of our sexuality as both a spiritual pursuit and a modern, healthy pursuit medically. So then what we see in our time and place, the sexual revolution that started in the 60s. Now, there were dissenters at that time as well. There were people who said, we don't think this is right, and normal sexuality is good for you. And some of those people who offered various birth control options to women were actually jailed at different times. I mean, so there was a women's liberation movement that happened at the turn of the 20th century that resulted in women's suffrage that was trying to come against this and say that that sexuality was not bad and harmful and all these things, but the prevailing force was that it was. So, and I think that what happened then in the 60s is kind of this pendulum swing back, especially if you take God out of the picture as far as any kind of the spiritual dimension kind of goes away in terms of the thinking about it and being a factor in considering it. And medically speaking, the physicians carry the day, and by the 60s we say that sex is good for you. It's not bad for you, it's good for you. In fact, it's so good for you that it's natural, it's organic, just anything goes. You should just be expressing it because it's part of how our bodies work and that kind of idea. So that's, I think, what the sexual revolution was reacting against, was this very much repressive, sex is bad for you sort of notion, saying, no, sex is good for you. Well, what happens is it really misses the middle ground there, that there might be a middle ground. And what I think the biblical picture is actually the middle ground, that that our sexuality, as we've described it in this series, that our sexuality is part of who we are as humans, created by God, and that sex within the context of its created place in marriage is a language that communicates commitment between a man and a woman, and that ratifies a special kind of a relationship between them. And in that context, it's very good, it's very right, and it's very free to be expressed in that context. So there's sanctity in marriage, that is, our sexuality has its expression in that context in a good way. Outside of that context, there are it's broken because it's not working how it's meant to work. We're not letting it be the language of commitment if we communicate outside of marriage. That did that make sense at all? Okay. Okay. So I was thinking we'd go from there to talking a little bit about where we are today on these kind of subjects. There have been some Christian writers who have wanted to say that our sexuality... I remember a book that I saw in a Christian bookstore a while back called Intended for Pleasure. And it's kind of a sex manual for Christians to be able to have great sex inside of marriage. I think even that kind of idea misses the point that the goal of sex is not to have a great sensual experience, but the goal of sex is to ratify a special relationship and to communicate the commitment that is being carried out in regular life on a day-to-day basis. So it's in that context that it's pleasure is certainly a part of it, but pleasure is not the goal. And so I think that's another place where the sexual revolution has missed in really turning us into thinking that our sexuality, the goal of our sexuality, is pleasure. And I think we can still go there in our Christian circles, that we can spiritualize it, we can do all kinds of things with saying that if it's under God's dominion, it can actually even be a spiritual experience. I think Jack was talking about a time that he knew of a movement, maybe you can talk about that in a minute, where it becomes an actual spiritual experience to have sex. So it becomes mystical, that kind of thing. I think instead, from the biblical view, it's more mundane than that. I mean, it's earthy, it's part of our bodies, and it's not inherently bad. That was another thing that the 19th century was working with, was kind of this view that anything that had to do with the body, that was where sin lived. And so if we could squash that part of ourselves, then we could live righteously and be holy. But I think the biblical view allows for an understanding that that God has created us in a particular way, and that just the way that our bodies work, and that in itself is not inherently wrong. It's actually inherently beautiful. And the sin that we bring with us, the fallenness that that mars all of our experience, can also certainly disfigure that experience, but it isn't automatically disfigured. So I think the other piece of this is this understanding of sin and how it can be thought of as something that's outside of us rather than something that's inside of us. I think of Jesus' words about it's not what goes into the man that defiles the man, but what comes out of the man. And this is where I think Finney and the perfectionists really missed, that if we do things a certain way, we can control our fallenness, our propensity for being evil. And the fact is, we can't. I mean, that's the whole point of the gospel story, is that it's bigger than us. We need help. We need a savior. We need redemption from that very difficult, broken part of ourselves. So the view of sin that it's not outside of us, but rather inside of us, I think is a more biblical perspective as well. So perhaps what we might talk about then from here is, how do we respond to this information now? How do we address living in what we're calling in this series Sodom in our current culture, and try to practice chastity and sexual purity, and yet not practice the repression of the Victorian age? So how can we be respectful of what might ought to be private that our culture doesn't necessarily see as private or needing to be private, versus what is part of our humanness that we can be freer to talk about and struggle together with as we work out our faith in a lot of different areas? And certainly our sexuality and our relationships is a big place in which God has us, in a context where he's working out who we are, what we want, and what we're going to do with what life gives us or doesn't give us. So that's about all I had prepared. Do you have anything to add?
I think it might be helpful to distinguish the Victorians from the Puritans, because often in the popular conception of things, we talk about somebody being puritanical. But I read a book on Puritan attitude toward sexuality, and it was actually quite good. I mean, they had a very, very healthy, very balanced, very biblical perspective, I think. They quoted some letters written by Puritan husbands to their wives and vice versa. And they saw the sacredness of marital sexuality, but they didn't have the Victorian view that there was something inherently ugly and dirty and taboo about sex, which is what usually people are trying to describe when they describe someone as puritanical. What they really mean is Victorian. I remember, I grew up before and through the sexual revolution, and I do remember the attitudes that I picked up from my culture in childhood were obviously very much affected by the Victorians. There was this sort of idea that sex was yucky. And I imagine it was a lot like the way certain parents probably keep their kids off drugs, by scaring the hell out of them about stuff. And there was a tendency to do that with respect to sexuality. in that era. We didn't have the theology. I mean, that was completely new to me. I ate graham crackers like crazy when I was little, but I had no reason for it. I wasn't trying to do nothing. But although we didn't have the theology, all we inherited was the attitude, an ungrounded attitude. Sex is yucky, but there's no reason given for why it is. We just all know that it is. And I think Nancy's right. That was very clearly what the sexual revolution was responding to and reacting against. It was also a rebellion against God, and therefore they were throwing out biblical view of sexuality in the mix when they rebelled against it. But all of their stated objectives were always in opposition to Victorian attitudes. It's healthy, it's natural, it's beautiful, it's not ugly, it's not evil. What's the other thing I was going to say? Well, maybe it'll come to me, but I lost my other... Oh, yeah. A good example of the... If any of you have read Kierkegaard's Either Or, he has a section of Either Or called The Diary of the Seducer, which is just a terrible, terrible thing, which I think is what he intended it to be. It's this diary of this man who seduces a young woman over the course of months, Kierkegaard's point, I think, is to try to poignantly and dramatically show the logical conclusions of hedonism. You know, where would it really lead? What would it really mean? What would it really look like to take hedonism to its logical conclusions? And you just see the abject cruelty of the man. I mean, he just has no heart whatsoever, no decency in him at all. But there's one scene in there where the woman is getting out of a carriage, and her long dress lifts up, and he just gets a little bit of a glimpse of her ankle, and he makes this big, huge deal out of what an erotic experience it was to get a glimpse of her ankle. That's the Victorian era, where we cover everything up. We even have long table skirts on the tables because the legs of the tables might remind you of a female leg, and we wouldn't anything like that to happen. So they were just obsessed with denying, avoiding, running from, and not acknowledging human sexuality whatsoever. So it was heavy. I mean, it was thick. And it wasn't that long ago that many of us were still feeling the effects of that kind of attitude and that kind of view of sexuality, where it was scary, you ran from it, you tried to pretend like it didn't even exist. And that's not the biblical perspective. I mean, you have a book like Song of Solomon in the Bible. The biblical authors are not, they're not, you don't find any section of the Bible that's bawdy, like some of the stuff in Shakespeare, because they're more respectful of sexuality than that. And I think the Bible is better than Shakespeare in that regard. But you don't have any sort of sense that they're running from it or hiding it or trying to deny it or reject it in any way. It's what God made us, and that's fine.
Yeah, they actually had manuals that prescribed how often a married couple should have sex, or rather not have sex. They went really far in regulating what a healthy sex life might be, and that was, I think one of them said once a month was more than enough. Others said that married people had the consolation of the good thing about being married was that it would burn out your sex drive and then you wouldn't need to have sex anymore after a while. And that would be good for both of you to then just not have it. So yeah, it was really, really thick. I had no idea. It's been a very interesting study. And I think that, like Jack said, I think we all have, you know, perhaps this is how your parents keep you from doing drugs, that you make it bad and dirty. We didn't have the theology. That makes a lot of sense to me. But I think what we don't do well now is that we don't... I think the biblical view does embrace us as sexual beings, and I don't think we have to deny that or repress that. And I think we still kind of have this on-off kind of attitude about our sexuality that says, don't even think about sexuality before marriage. And then it's like you walk down the aisle and it's just supposed to flip the on switch and you're supposed to know what's going on. And so I think that we could benefit from having a more open dialogue, especially for unmarried people, in terms of understanding how our sexuality exhibits itself in appropriate ways apart from being married, that there is, we're still sexual beings even if we're not able to express it in a relationship. And I think that those are important things to take into account in terms of understanding who we are and what we want and what we bring with us into relationships. We can go a longer way, I think, toward understanding ourselves in that way. Ideas, questions, comments, thoughts?
I have a question about, in fact, what you just said. I think it was in the very first lecture, Jack, you said marriage has the place of priority in thinking about sex and marriage, and that sex was created for marriage, not marriage for sex. And it's been interesting reading some of the ancient literature that we have, because, well, not just in ancient times, but even today, sex is such the driving force of history. I mean, it's the theme, it's the thing, it's what motivates every character in the story to do what they do. And you said, you know, we walk down the aisle and we're expected to all of a sudden begin to understand what sexuality is. But it seems like that's right. I mean, it seems like sexuality was created for marriage, and it's in marriage that we initiate that dialectic, you know, of trying to comprehend and understand what our sexuality is, because otherwise, of what relevance is it? I mean, it's not the thing that I use to explain, you know, why I act out in anger towards the people around me, like you might in, you know, Freudian psychology or something. So can you respond to that?
Say that last part. What do you mean by the last part?
Well, when a lot of times it seems like in psychology, sexuality, the repression of sexuality is used as something to explain behavioral phenomena.
Okay. Yeah. Well, what I'm not saying is that we should express our sexuality outside of marriage. But I am saying that we might have room to understand ourselves as sexual beings outside of marriage, because we are. And that part of ourselves, I think, can still be understood in a way that gives us information about how to interact with people, even. In other words, if I don't know that I'm a sexual person, for example, if I try to deny that or not know it because I'm not married and I don't have a valid place to express it, then I think that's where we tend toward expressing it inappropriately. In other words, it will come out in, I don't know how, maybe flirting, being seductive, something. But the more I can understand who I am and what I bring, the more I can be responsible with it. So that's what I'm suggesting. Not that we're free to express it outside of marriage. I don't think it's appropriate to do that. But that it is part of who we are, and it's true. Now, I don't go with Dr. Freud on the repression theory. But that's a whole nother story. But I do think that it's maybe what I'm saying sounds similar to that, but it's got some real big differences. So perhaps because I'm not married and I have sexual energy, I decide to channel it in some other way that is appropriate. But if I don't even know that I have it, it's more likely to come out in inappropriate ways. So that's what I'm suggesting. Does that make sense? Does that answer your question? You're right about that's the context in which I'm ultimately going to learn about what my sexuality is for and how it works. And I think that is right. But there are things that our bodies do that we can understand without being afraid that our body has just done something that was wrong. And our bodies respond sexually sometimes, even when it's not, you know, when there's not another person in the room. But to understand that and to respond to it responsibly, I think is a better idea than to say that's something I should never have happened and I need to push it away, because I don't think we can.
So it's a difference between understanding how sexuality as a part of my humanness fits into that picture of what it means to be a human being versus mm-hmm. exploring the nuances of what my sexuality is.
Yes, right.
In itself.
Yeah, it's a good way to put it.
I think implicit in what Nancy is saying is it's one thing to be interested and have sexual desire. It's another thing to not act righteously in the context of that. I mean, because of the Victorian sort of attitudes, the idea of what it meant to be righteous and good was that you actually transcended sexual desire such that you didn't have any. And I think that's what Nancy is saying is, well, how true is that? How honest is that? How much in touch with reality is that? The Bible is not asking us to remake ourselves, to recreate ourselves so that we don't respond the way we respond. What the Bible is asking is, knowing that you respond in a particular way, are you moral enough, are you righteous enough to ask the question, what's the appropriate way to behave, what's the appropriate perspective to take, what's the appropriate set of attitudes to take toward the fact that this is how I'm responding? What do I do with that? Is that right? And also keep in mind, there's two senses of sexuality that we've been talking about in the series. One is my being susceptible to sexual desire, which is what I think we're talking about right now. But there's another sense, and that is just the fact that we are different as male and female. And that's something that we can acknowledge and know and understand and explore in our singleness without any problem. Know what it means to be male and know what it means to be female and come to terms with that.
You were telling the story about the woman stepping out of the carriage and revealing her ankle and all that. Could you address or define the concept of modesty and what that would look like in our culture?
Well, I do think that must be culturally relative. So there's a certain amount of relativity that is just built into it. That is what one culture finds seductive or erotic, another culture doesn't. And probably just through familiarity and ordinariness and stuff like that. So we have to cut one another some slack in that regard, I think. I do think it was a mistake, probably, when the first thing the missionaries want to do is put clothes on natives who don't even have a problem with it. I mean, that's not the essence of the gospel. That's not really at the heart of what this is all about, on the one hand. On the other hand, we do need to be being as sensitive to the messages of our culture and what's happening in our culture. We need to be alert to that, aware of that, and not participate in what is intended to be erotic, seductive, titillating, attractive, sexually attractive. You know, we live in a culture where it's just expected that, of course, what you want to do is be a sexual magnet. I mean, that's part of your self-esteem, is to be able to control people through attracting them sexually. Well, that doesn't make any sense to me. That's wrong. So I don't have any firm answers. I know it when I see it. You know, I know when, you know, when a woman's presence, when her sexuality speaks louder than her personhood, something's not right, it seems to me, about that. It seems to me that I need to be able to relate to her as a person in a mind, not a body. And when that is made difficult for me by the way a woman dresses or conducts herself, I think that has crossed the boundary of modesty and is no longer modest. But on the other hand, I need to take full responsibility for, I need to get over it. I need to respond responsibly in that situation.
It seems to me that far more ancient than the Victorian era is this Catholic virgin worship that I've read about. This Catholic virgin worship, that whole higher moral plane that Mary existed on, and it seemed to be inseparable from her virginity. And that history and the cultural weight of that had to have been an influence over the Victorian concepts along those lines. Have you read more about that?
Well, I have read that somebody that I was reading did in fact actually trace the influence of that on the Protestants in this country who are developing these ideas. I don't remember the details of that, but yes, they did suggest that was a powerful factor, powerful influence.
And that's of pagan origin. That's not biblical origin. And it seems to me that whatever this thing is comes more from our humanity than it does from our 1800s vision of what culture should be and what relationships should look like. And somewhere back in there is the root of that connection. And I just wish someone could clarify that.
Yeah, I don't know if I can. I think you're right. I think there has always been a tendency. You see this in the whole history of ideas and culture after culture. There's this proclivity that we have to look at the body as bad and something beyond the body, transcending the body, as good. And I think that's where the fascination with virginity comes from, is the purity comes from the fact that they have transcended their physical sexuality altogether somehow. So I think you're right. I think there's something to that. I haven't put my finger on what that is. It may very well be a combination of sexuality being such a powerful, compelling drive within us on the one hand, and then the reality of human sinfulness on the other hand, makes sexual sin such a... itself such a powerfully destructive sin in our lives. And so experiencing that, I think it would be easy to, without the biblical framework to help us interpret it, I think it would be easy for us to just decide, my body's just bad, you know, my body's just evil. All it does is bring me grief and destruction. There's a great passage in the Republic, in the early book of the Republic, where I can't remember his name, but Socrates is talking to this older man, and he's saying, "I'm getting old now, and finally, I don't remember how he puts it now, but I'm enjoying myself. I'm enjoying my life. I don't have my sexual desires are not as strong. I'm not plagued by them any longer." And you know, it's on the one hand, you know, you understand what he's saying. It's almost the universal experience of mankind that we end up being plagued by our sexuality as much as we are, or more than we are, blessed by it, because we don't have the moral wherewithal and the ability to do it right. And it haunts us, and it's just a plague that we experience it as a kind of plague. So you can see why it would be easy to come to the conclusion it just must be an evil thing, it must not be a good thing at all.
When inside the marital relationship, if ever, is sex inappropriate, can you give an example? And could you do this in a synopsis, 200, 300 word maximum? No, just kidding.
I can barely hear you, Tony.
Yeah,
can
you? I missed the very first part.
Inside the marital relationship, when, if ever, is sex inappropriate? Oh. And could you give an example?
Well, so when is it ever inappropriate? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, inside the marital relationship.
Well, whenever it's not mutual, it's inappropriate. Whenever it is strictly self-serving and selfish, it's inappropriate. I think, personally, that there should be boundaries on sexual
practices.
I don't think all sexual practices are inherently valid. I think some of them would be humiliating and demeaning and are inherently perverse. Now, that may be controversial, and maybe people would draw the line differently, but there's got to be some boundary somewhere. I mean, I never imagined even some of the practices that are practices in our culture today. And they just keep pushing the limits and making it kinkier and kinkier and kinkier, and there's something fundamentally wrong about that. Freedom is one thing, but kinkiness and perversion is not freedom. That's something else. That's different.
I think it goes back to that, the idea of what the purpose of sex is, because we're just awash in the idea that the purpose of sex is for pleasure. And if that's the model that you're going with, then pleasure is going to be, you're going to try newer and different and kinkier and bizarrer things in order to heighten the experience, rather than understanding that. I mean, in a way, understanding the purpose of sexuality biblically is really very freeing, because it kind of takes the focus off of performance and off of what actually happens there, and gives you the freedom to just be together in any kind of sexual experience you decide on within those.
Does that?
Well, so you would have a problem then with two selfish people having sex in a marriage?
And that might be a problem, because, you know, you're not going to get out without doing that. But
well, you may be a selfish person having marriage, but even selfish people can, as a matter of principle, recognize the need to not act on that selfishness. And it's when, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of sex happening in marriages that's awfully self-serving and one-sided and selfish and taking rather than giving, and there's no shame in that. I mean, it's my right. I get to have sex, so get it. That's can't be right.
Well, and it also seems to me that the way we work is that we don't always know until afterwards what's going on. I mean, not just in sex. I don't mean just sex. But we don't know our motives very well. I mean, that's part of our problem. So part of this whole relational thing that God has us in is a context to work that out with each other. So it's not like you're going to do it perfectly. But that's what you're going to be working with, is taking on the responsibility of evaluating.
I was going to ask if you know where the beginning, even maybe in ancient Judaism, or where the idea that the story of the fall is a metaphor for sexual activity, and that was the instigation of the sense of sexual desire, and that's where what you were saying earlier, Nancy, about the beginning of this problem of sin. And that is, I mean, I remember, it's been a long, long time, but the movie Carrie, where the woman's cycle is the curse, and all that is just this continuation of the fact that we were fallen creatures, and that whole story of the garden is that a how far back does that go? Does it go all the way back to Judaism, or is that something that was popular? And what centuries did that take hold? Does anybody remember?
I don't know. I know in what I read about the 19th century that was certainly what they were working with, was understanding what happened at the fall. And a lot of them understood it as when they became sexual was when the fall happened, that passion and appetite, even eating the fruit, giving in, that kind of thing, and relating it to being ashamed of their nakedness, that related it to their sexuality. And so that was what they were trying to undo with this idea of getting rid of the passion. Because if it was voluntary for them, it came into play for them with that action, these people concluded that we could undo it somehow. So I don't know what the history before that.
Well, I think you see it as early as Augustine, and I don't know if it went back before him, but I'm not aware that it would have been true in Judaism up to that point. I think it was a Christian heresy, a Christian perversion. I believe, maybe somebody can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I believe it's still pretty much standard doctrine within the Roman Catholic Church today that the act of sin in the garden was sexual intercourse, that the eating of the apple was a metaphor for sexual intercourse. Am I wrong about that?
That's a Catholic...
I don't want to mislead you, but I think that's right. Take that with a grain of salt, though. I don't know.
It's curious how usually when any teacher or preacher in biblical text, the metaphor is never connected. I mean, they never...
Yeah.
You know, there's...
Paul never expounds that.
Yeah, on the symbolism of the garden. The other thing is more historical, Nancy. I was going to ask about, was the idea of Victorianism, was it mostly urban because, or did it carry itself through? I keep thinking of North America in the 1800s and how our culture was getting incredibly widespread, and the influence of urban tradition and the table legs and on all that may have been lost in some of our expansion. And whether or not it was a British, French kind of thing, or was it pervasive throughout Europe?
What I was reading about was in this country and how we responded to it. And apparently there was a unique response here because of Protestantism being kind of the norm. And they did say that it certainly seemed to come along with the Industrial Revolution, because when the rural society, the more agricultural society was going on, having lots of kids to have lots of help was considered very normal, and you know, there wasn't any taboo about sex. Sex seemed to be much healthier, you know, practiced in a much more healthy way. So they did connect it to the development of the Industrial Revolution and the focus of authority shifting into the medical field as a result of that. Does that make sense?
One last question I had. I don't know if it'll fit in tonight's topic, but the current, or about, well, maybe it's further than 30 years ago, but the idea of... that there's did you address this at the beginning? I can't remember, Jack, about, you've talked about it before, about how there's the teaching in the church of there's actually a spiritual thing that happens in, is it Corinthians, where he's talking about joining yourself to.
Yeah.
Have you discussed that, this, and would it fit tonight?
I don't remember. Nancy alluded to back in the, would have been the 70s, back when they have the Christian World Liberation Front in Berkeley, and I was living on the other side of the bay, but I'd go over and visit them occasionally. There was a guy on the fringes of the Christian World Liberation Front who began writing and teaching and thinking a lot about sexuality, and he ended up, you know, basically teaching a kind of sexual mysticism, a sexual Christian mysticism, that in Jesus and in the Spirit you can have this kind of sexual experience where you, I don't remember now how he framed the result, but know the love of God, experience the love of God, you know, whatever, and turned it into this really metaphysical, ontological kind of thing. Yeah, I just think that's way overreaching. I like what Nancy said earlier, that from a biblical perspective, it's okay for sex to just simply be kind of mundane. It doesn't have to be this transcendent experience in order to be meaningful and in order to fulfill its purpose and to have the function that it has. So, you know, that's really trying to smuggle a whole different kind of spirituality into Christianity, using sex as the way to do that. But I did grow up as a child with this notion that there is something metaphysical and ontological that happens. It wasn't mystical, but this ontological thing happened. And the way us little church kids were kept virgins is by saying, if you have sex with somebody, you are married to them in the eyes of God. You have become one with them in the eyes of God. And I think I did comment on that when we were looking at the passage in Genesis about marriage, that I don't think that's what Genesis is saying. It's not describing an ontological event, a metaphysical event. You're not literally becoming one with someone. But in marriage, the commitment, the moral responsibility and duty that I am taking on and I am promising to my wife is that we are going to become one. We will be one. Economically, socially, emotionally, psychologically, we're going to work toward a kind of intimate understanding of one another and sharing of life experience together, that it is as if we are sharing one life together. But that's not something that happens to us. That's a promise that we are making to one another, I think.
Nancy, so what you were reading was mainly about here in America. You said it was about here in America?
Yes.
Okay. All right. I was just curious, did the resource have anything specific on England and France at that same time period? Were they drifting away from this more, or?
The part that I read didn't go into what was happening in Europe. I think there is a section in that text, though, that talks about that, so I could refer you to it.
Yeah, that'd be great.
It was another book I was reading about the Republican movement in France having something to do with how hysterical women began to be treated.
Yeah, that's what I was just reading about myself today.
Oh, is that
right?
So
I was curious to see what was going on behind the scenes in France.
Mm-hmm.
Because if the Victorian age is affecting France's time, you could see this as a response of the man, you know, being very perverted on the side, but keeping this good image in the public,
mm-hmm.
because of what Freud was discovering and then decided to suppress because it ruined his reputation.
Yes. In fact, the I guess his name is Charcot, who was the guy who first started identifying hysteria in women as being related to sexual trauma in women. And Freud took this idea further in Vienna. He published a paper called something like The Etiology of Hysteria. Is that it? Are we reading the same book?
I don't know.
Trauma and Recovery?
Yeah, that's what I'm reading. Yeah.
Yeah, really excellent book by Judith Herman called Trauma and Recovery. She talks about the history of his work and then Freud's work identifying, when he wrote this paper on hysteria, saying that he began to identify that women who were considered hysterics had all kinds of different symptoms. But this was before any kind of notion of sexual trauma being related to it, so it was really groundbreaking. And Freud wrote a paper talking about how most of the women that he was treating as hysterics, he believed, had an early traumatic experience sexually and that they had been victimized. So he wrote that paper and was pretty much shunned by the community, and then within a year recanted his theories on that. And then in that moment took it further and developed his whole psychosexual developmental model for saying that these women had These were experiences in their fantasies as children. They weren't real experiences, and it was a real tragedy that it went that way. But she argues that it was culturally, it just was not going to be heard. It wasn't just about Freud being a coward. And that then it kind of went into slumber for another many years before
Well, what I found was so interesting, based, I hadn't thought of it till tonight, about the Victorian age, was that it specifically said that Freud decided to discount it because he concluded, the logical conclusion was, because so many women and children, young girls, had this problem, that he would have to say that almost every proletariat and bourgeoisie, this, you know, this was happening to this mass amount of people. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering if that was directly related to the Victorian culture, because they had so suppressed, you know, they couldn't have sex with their wives, so there was this underground of...
I've wondered that, too, if there wasn't, in the midst of this repression, a lot of really horrible things happening behind very closed doors. There was also... another source I read talked about Freud himself. One of the theories on why he recanted, this was never completely proven, I don't think, but was that he was discovering his own family trauma, that he had a hysterical brother who he believed, he was discovering evidence that his father had been the perpetrator of his brother and his three sisters, I believe, and that if that was the case, then his father was one of those perpetrators. And it was right about that time, he wrote that in a letter to a friend of his. He discounted it from there, didn't go there. And then I think the guy that he wrote that letter to, his son, when he grew up, exposed his father as a perpetrator and said that the time of Freud's recantation of his theory coincided with the time that his friend was acting out in his family and was victimizing him. So it's very convoluted, very twisted, and very tragic. But it's so much a part of how we view, how we don't want to know what's true, and how we just want to say everything's okay. But that Trauma and Recovery is a very good book. Also, the other book I referred to is called Banished Knowledge by Alice Miller. And she talks a lot about how theories deny truth. And are, that's what they're for in her book.
Why is it that I feel that only that only a man can be a true hedonist, like that only a man could be that vindictive and that cruel and that harsh and that evil? Why do
I can't hear you.
Hello?
There you go.
How's that? Why do I feel that only a man could be a seducer and hedonist and vicious and cruel and vindictive? Why is that? Like, why did God give so much power to sexuality and so... And make that such a force in a man's way experiences life, and yet at the same time, why does he give men so much power and freedom to act and be horrible monsters? Yeah, you got that? Answer all those.
Go for it, Jack.
Why did God do all that? Is that what you're...
Yeah.
There about how women are completely innocent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And did you say only men can be seducers? Did I hear you say that?
No. Are you talking about the balance of power, kind of?
I think that's why.
Molestations and these cruelties that are committed to innocence and youth. Why does God give power to men and then also give men this sex drive thing that is so consuming? Like, I mean, I don't know. It would have been simpler if
he to make women all strong and buff and make women all men all
and
weedy.
The gatekeepers.
Yeah, and the gatekeepers. That would make all the sense in the world. Why don't you answer that?
Well, I can't answer it in the form that you've asked it. I don't know why God did it that way. But I think what's behind it is male sexuality. We probably haven't talked about this enough, but I think male sexuality just is fundamentally different than female sexuality. Now, this may be a terrible generalization, but I'm drawing on a lot of different sources, and I think this makes sense. But there's obviously individual differences among all of us, so this may be not map onto every person. But as a generalization, it seems to me that men are wired in such a way that the physical intimacy of sexuality is more inherently meaningful to them than it is to women. Women contextualize it, need it contextualized much more than men do in order for it to have the same meaning and significance. So, men are more capable, therefore, it seems to me, in their perversion, are more capable of separating their drive, their physical drive, from morality and anything else. I mean, it just to be consumed by the drive alone. And I just think it's not the way females are typically, in their perversity, typically where they go, just because it's not so easy for them to go there as it is for men. I think they would go there just as well if it was just as easy, but I don't think it's as easy for women. What's odd to me is where our culture is going, because what I see happening is women starting to imitate that. And that's really scary. I mean, that's really scary.
Yeah, I think that as our sexuality becomes more and more objectified, the way our culture is going, I think that's what's taking women there. That it's becoming more visual, it's becoming, more objectified and more mutually exploitive, if you will, so that men are no longer the only exploiters like they might have been 100 years ago. But yeah, women, I would just add to that I think that, the weakness, the way men's weakness exhibits itself might be in that kind of a display, which is really harmful and really tragic. I think women, the way women work is different than that and can be, in some ways, can be missed easier. But that it can be just as for women in terms of like hiding in romantic notions or emotionality. We'll talk more about pornography addiction and romance addiction, I think, in another week or two. But anyway, just.
And it just—it's horrible that there, in the course of human history, have been played out like countless silent tragedies and abuses of like innocence, and that how both sides in some respects are pitiable for both being the victim and being the monster. I mean, it's just sad, the state of human nature.
Yeah, amen. Absolutely. I think that's what I was getting at earlier, is the destruction that has been wrought in the human race due to sexuality easily leads to the conclusion that it was a bad invention. You know, that this is just evil, just awful. But it wasn't that way from the beginning. God did not intend it to be employed in that way.
You guys already said most of what I was thinking of, but I mean, just growing up in the American high school culture, I think quite a bit removed, you know, maybe not in time, but culturally removed from a lot of what you guys are talking about and a lot of what, was part of your early experiences. I mean, there's not much Victorianism left out there.
Really?
You know, mm-hmm. and it sounds like such a foreign concept, I mean. And it's really interesting just how much of a homogenization trend there is towards, you know, everybody seeing sexuality the same way, and and the way that, you know, men and women are going about sexuality in really, you know, in the same way, essentially, and as if it's you know, bears no relation to, you know, who you are as a man or who you are as a woman. It's just sort of this, you know, this general tool for getting and getting and getting and getting. And I think it, I don't know, I mean, I agree with you, Toby, in a lot of respects, you know, and I think that, I mean, yeah, it is tragic, but it just seems like, I mean, there's, with the homogenization, there's such a trend, you know, with youth for women to start becoming sexually dominant as well, but it ends up going in a different direction, and you know, like what you were talking about with guys and strength and domination. I mean, you know, there's this, I mean, there's so many girls out there that have discovered that they can wield this incredible power with their attractiveness. And there's, I mean, I think there's a lot of damage that is done that way to guys. And, you know, unfortunately, where the damage that guys can do to women is easier to see. And so it's easier to point out. And there's more of a cultural drive towards, you know, exploring that damage and exploring the, you know, the repercussions of male sexuality upon females, that there's kind of corresponding silence as far as, you know, guys taking stock of sort of, you know, the emotional damage that's done by sort of a misused feminine sexuality in our culture. And I mean, but I think it's there, you know, and I think it's dangerous just to start, like, you know, going, why men, why men, why men? And you guys talked about this, that it's a human phenomenon.
We're all very broken. And I think that the tragic thing is that the culture that we live in encourages it, endorses it, promulgates it, says it's good for us to go that direction. I mean, I think what you're talking about is the legacy of the sexual revolution that happened when we were younger. And I think it's just tragic. I don't know where it's going to go. I think it's the traumatization of all kinds of people happening because our sexuality has been so objectified and so traumatized by this idea that any expression of it is just something that I ought to get for myself.
What does society gain by keeping it secret, by keeping it all this silent? Like, why is there this whole, it seems like almost a force, like keeping lies going in society. Like, what is that? Like, why don't mothers who are abused teach their daughters, you know, good values about how they should value themselves? I mean, why do we perpetuate this evil generation, these lies over and over again?
I would recommend Judith Herman's book, Trauma and Recovery. She has some thoughts about that. And also Alice Miller. She talks a lot about that denying reality is what we do. And I think that's really true about what our sinfulness looks like in real life, is that we don't want to know what reality is. And so even the hurtful things that have happened to us, we retranslate them somehow so that they don't have to have the impact that they have. And then because we don't know it, we can do it again without recognizing it. And the really difficult work of going back there and knowing it, not just up here, but in here, is, I think, where healing can come from.
And the abusers typically, I mean, most abusers don't admit that they're abusers. They're doing some beautiful thing. I mean, they've lied to themselves and rationalized to such an extent that they're not even looking at it the way you and I are looking at it. That's, and I think Nancy's right, that's at the heart of human sinfulness itself, is that ability that we have to lie to ourselves and believe our own lies and live the world of our lives rather than in reality and in truth.
I think maybe you just answered my question, but Nancy, you were talking about the Victorian era and how there was so much abuse going on that, you know, maybe Freud missed or brushed over because it was easier, but and that was coming out of suppression. Maybe you've just answered it in saying it's human fallenness, but why does it seem like abuse and sexual trauma is so prevalent in our society now when, like you were saying, Jack, there are so many options, there's so much going on that it's like, I mean, I feel ridiculous saying I'm surprised by people saying they have experienced sexual trauma when I talk to people because it's, I mean, I continuously am. Every time I hear about it, I still am surprised because it seems so tragic to me. But then I continue to hear about it and continue to hear about it and continue to hear about it. And it seems like it doesn't leave anyone aside. And I guess I'm trying to understand and trying to grasp why our society still feels like that is such a, why that kind of abuse still needs to exist when it's free for anyone who wants it. I mean, it's not like
It's not repressed.
It needs
anymore.
To be gone and taken right from helpless individuals. Instead, it could be very easily achieved if they just asked. But
well, I think that the feminists would answer that question by saying that because it's more about power than it is about sexuality, and I think that there's something to that. There's a power dynamic that happens that's a part of an abusive situation most often. But I think that at the heart of it is our refusal to know what reality is and to be, and to go without our needs being met, to struggle with the pain of our lives. I mean, we all have trauma and we all want to redefine it on some level. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I mean, there's trauma and then there's trauma. And, you know, there's a lot of, there's a continuum there. But we want to resist knowing what's hard to know.
When I hear about, you know, incestuous child abuse or something like that, I react the same way. I mean, it just seems unthinkable to me. I mean, I think about all of my parental instincts to protect my own children. How on earth could I ever become the perpetrator of trauma against my own children? I mean, I don't understand that. But you look at, is it 1st or 2nd Timothy, one of the things that he describes in the latter days, he describes the natural affections being basically erased or eliminated or something like that. And that's got to be the kind of thing that he's talking about, is things that are just even instinctual in us that ought to make us kind of halfway civilized and decent just out of instinct, not alone goodness and righteousness, but just out of instinct, that even those are going to go by the wayside in the depths of our perversity and the depths of our fallenness. By God's grace, I am being sanctified and those instincts are still intact. And so that just seems unthinkable to me. But imagine if they were erased, you know? Imagine if I could lie to myself and believe my own lies to such an extent that I want what I want for whatever reasons those are and nothing else matters. Then do I have what it takes to be that abuser? Yeah, I probably do.
Well, there's a whole line of work out to promoting that it actually has some sort of degree of credibility where writers write that it's good for children.
Yeah.
And they,
yeah.
You know, seduce themselves into thinking. And there was a guy in San Francisco State University that was promoting that idea. It's even caught up and tied up in some of the whole Catholic stuff. One of the writers in that group, early on group, was in the Catholic system that was,
yeah, I think what the stuff that Nancy was covering is a good reminder for us. You know, when you have a news report that this study has shown that, you know, abusing your child sexually is good for them. Yeah, well, graham crackers were supposed to be good for us, too.
They should be.
that is an intriguing theory, that our theories are intended to hide the truth, not to disclose the truth. That's very interesting.
So I'm hearing a lot of the Victorian era was about not talking about sexuality. Would you say then that a biblical worldview would be more willing to talk about sexuality throughout the normal day, whatever was going on?
I think so. Respectfully.
Respectfully, and I was going to use the same word. And we've lost that entirely. I mean, we don't even know where the lines are because our culture is so over the top on it. But I think part of what could make it respectful is that it's not in a large crowd, perhaps. Maybe it's in a small group that we talk about it, or maybe it's between two or three people, or just women, or just men. Or those are the kinds of things that could make it respectful, I think, rather than just not going there. Versus, let's talk about anything and everything because biblically that would be okay. I think there ought to be boundaries on it out of respect for people and what they bring. And yeah.
I must confess, this may be the Victorian in me speaking rather than the saint in me speaking. I'm not sure which. But I get very uncomfortable with body humor. Like in Shakespeare and stuff like that, where to make a joke out of our sexuality and physicality and so on, and to kind of make a mockery of that, I'm uncomfortable with that. And I don't know whether it's because it's crossed my Victorian sensibilities, residual Victorian sensibilities. I don't think so, though. I think it's crossing a real boundary that probably shouldn't be crossed. That is not respecting our sexuality like I think is appropriate.
I'm going to change the subject again. I'd like to go back to what Toby and Colin were both talking about, and also what Brian said about modesty. I was flipping through this woman's magazine yesterday that I used to really enjoy, but I haven't read it in several years, and it's really gotten trashy, like horrible, potty mouth, awful. But it just really struck me how there was a little article about how it's cool to hit on the cute Hare Krishna guys who are handing out the pamphlets, because they're all really cute and they wear these semi-see-through robes and you should like smile at them and everything. And it was just really like the way it seemed like women were being encouraged to think wasn't even natural. And I mean natural the way you guys talk about it, like not necessarily even good, just the way, it wasn't the way women's minds work. If I know women, I mean, I mostly hang out with nice girls. it just seems so twisted that, I mean, like you said, Colin, like women are, you know, becoming more dominant, or like they think that's what they're supposed to do. You know, okay, so we're supposed to objectify men now and like be aggressive in this just sick way.
Whoa. I think what I was thinking about is just the increasing interest that that women, and not just women, you know, but you know, let's take women, a lot of women that, you know, my age are taking in the effect that their attractiveness can have on guys, because it's gratifying to themselves, because, you know, it's, you know, they are the center of attention, you know, they are beautiful, they are more valuable than somebody else who's not as attractive, or, you know, whatnot, without, and so they display that and encourage that, and without taking into account what that's communicating to guys, and that you can have these guys who then are, you know, responding to that because, you know, they're attractiveness is being communicated to them. And I mean, you know, guys are just weak that way, you know, and yet it doesn't always stop at a physical response. I mean, there are deep emotional realities in guys, and I think there's a lot of women that aren't taking into account that, you know, when they're communicating that, you know, that, you know, a lot of these guys are getting attached in ways that they're not ready to back up. So I think that's what I was thinking. Okay. You know, so these poor little Hare Krishna guys are thinking they're in love.
I think we're about out of time, are we? Okay. Maybe we better stop with that. Thanks, everyone.